Did you play college football? Do you know someone who did? Or are you just a huge college football fan? You need to go check out www.footballvideos.com, where we have tens of thousands of college football games played as far back as 1905 available for purchase. Take an amazing trip back in time, take a seat at the top of the press box, and watch the entire game as if you were there. For more information, call 717-732-5643 or email us at wdr@footballvideos.com. Hey, welcome everybody to the NFL's Grueling Truth Legend Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo. Gridiron Mo is a new interactive football app where you get to call what you think the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo at www.gridironmo.com. As always for the Legend Show, I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and I want to welcome in a special guest from the Cincinnati Bengals, played in Super Bowl 23, offensive lineman Brian Blados.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
All right. You can't call me Michael. Only my sister and my mom ever called me Michael, and I was in trouble whenever I heard it. So.
Well, I don't think the fans want to hear other names that I might want to call you, huh?
Oh, we don't know each other well enough for you to hate me yet. You got to give that another hour. So let's start it off. When did you start playing football, and when did your goal become to be an NFL player?
Well, as everybody, you play pickup ball in the backyard, and as you play, you kind of know your skill level starting off. And when you're as fast as the small guys and you're as strong as the bigger guys, you kind of know that something's up. And then when I always played flag football at first, and then when I got to Virginia, I got my first taste of tackle football. And that was a different thing, but I think the flag football kind of got me in a position to where I got my, I learned how to move my feet and be able to run back and forth a little bit better, a little bit quicker, instead of being in the trenches all the time.
All right. Now, you chose to go to a basketball school to play football at the University of North Carolina. You want to tell us a little bit what into that helped make that decision?
Well, the mindset was we were going to change it to a football school, which I think over the 4 years we did our best by going to four bowl games in a row.
Yeah, but they had Michael Jordan there at the same time. So,
well, you know what? That's the funny thing. Everybody says, oh, yeah, you went to school with Michael Jordan, but he wasn't the stud on the team. You had Sam Perkins, you had James Worthy, Jimmy Black, and there was a couple other guys on the team that were – Michael Jordan wasn't, the go-to guy. Yeah, he was a tremendous talent, but Dean Smith had a way of kind of putting those guys in their position and making them earn their stripes, I guess, as you would say.
All right, you got there your freshman year. The Tar Heels go 11-1. You had a player on that team by the name of Lawrence Taylor. What do you remember about Lawrence at North Carolina?
Not a big guy, but the intensity. The one story I have with Lawrence was, he really wasn't that big a guy to me, because I was 300 pounds. I think I was one of the first 300 pounders down at Carolina. So we're in the weight room, and the coaches, he's got the new coaching staff because Coach Dooley had just left the year before. So Coach Crum, he's a slight guy too. And the coaches were in the weight room, and we were doing our weights, and you could see that Lawrence wasn't doing much. And so one of the coaches went over to him and said, Lawrence, well, we're going to have to have you start lifting some of these weights. He kind of just threw a couple plates on a bar and just started throwing it up and down in the air, and kind of like walked away. He said, is that enough? And walked out of the room. And I was a freshman. I'm like, oh, my God, I couldn't even squat that, let alone throw it around like he was doing. So that was my indoctrination of him. And then being a scout team member on the field, that was another treat.
All right, so the Tar Heels were, like you said, they were probably as successful as they'd ever been the 4 years you were there. You want to talk a little bit about your relationship with head coach Dick Crum and just give us some thoughts on him?
I've been blessed. I mean, when I say that, I've been blessed with some coaches from the beginning to the end that have not only got me to the position I was with football, but as a person. Dick Crum was more than a head coach. He was more than a figurehead. He was, he knew how to talk to the guys. He knew how to relate, even though he was, he didn't come across as this big, mean, tough guy. He knew, he understood 21-year-old kids And when you look back at it, it's like amazing. You know, we talk about cradle of coaches and stuff. His coaching staff, you had Denny Morrison, who coached for many years in the NFL. You had John Matsko, who's still coaching in the NFL. You had Vic Fangio was actually a part of their staff at one point. He was at, I think he was a, you know, a grad assistant. So Kevin Wilson, coaching at Indiana now. So there's, those guys knew what they were doing at the time because it shows in the legacy that he left behind.
All right, 1981, you guys won your bowl game over Arkansas in a game played in the fog. What do you remember about that game?
It was the whole trip was kind of like we were on a road trip. We started down in Daytona, worked our way. We went to Orlando for the day for Disney World, and then we headed up to Jacksonville, and everything was fine. Practices went fine, and we get out to play. We were kind of a little intimidated by Arkansas just because they had a reputation, and we, you know, being in the ACC, we really didn't get our taste outside of the ACC too much. I mean, we'd always play the Miami of Ohio's and some other MAC teams along the way, but we were in the spotlight, and then all of a sudden that fog rolled in, and we were having the time of our life. I mean, even though the fog rolled in, the game wasn't too visible. My family's watching, and they say, well, I couldn't see you that much. The clips that you could see were just like holes were wide open. We were just having a good old time. We had Kelvin Bryant as a running back, who was another one of those kind of like Hall of Fame performances. So very lucky.
And you talk about Kelvin Bryant. I know that I found an article from like 1983 where they dubbed you the 1,000-yard blocker in college because you blocked for three straight 1,000-yard rushers, Kelvin Bryant, Tyrone Anthony, and Ethan Horton, who went on to be a tight end with the Raiders. Tell us a little bit of what it was like blocking for those three great college running backs.
Well, you took pride in it. And the reason we took pride in it is because when offensive linemen wore down at Carolina, you didn't want to be an offensive lineman down. People, when they came down there, they didn't want to be an offensive lineman down in Carolina because their work ethic was so strenuous. I mean, we'd get into practice. Well, we'd get before practice. Coach Matsko was, everything was repetition. The first step, the 6-inch step, blah, blah, blah. I could still go over the repetition that we'd go every day of the week. And it kind of paid off, as you know, Coach Crum said, okay, you guys are making these monstrous holes, and we were having fun doing it. And some of those running backs got some big yardage in the early games playing East Carolina, Furman, and stuff like that. Not that they're the bad teams, but we took advantage of it. And then it became something where we kind of said, okay, let's just take over this whole team kind of, and let's run the ball until we get everybody 1,000 yards. And I guess it was a Duke game, last game of the season. Tyrone Anthony needed almost 200 yards. And Kelvin, I think, needed – between them both, they needed over 300 yards. And we went out and got it. They let us do it. So that was like the icing on the cake for me.
Now, you had a great college career at North Carolina. The Bengals had three draft picks in the first round, 1984 draft. What were your thoughts when the Bengals drafted you in the first round in 1984?
Oh, another one of those funny stories. I was sitting back in the day when you were getting drafted. It wasn't all the ESPN stuff, but the Seattle Seahawks had, I think it was a 12th pick or a 14th pick, and the guy knocks on our front door and he says, I'm with Seattle. I said, oh, okay, what are you doing here? And he goes, we're going to be taking you. So I'm kind of geeked up. We're watching it downstairs and got my family and friends around, and 12th pick comes along, and the Seattle guy goes, well, you're next. And I'm saying, oh, good. You know, I'd like to go out to Seattle, see what it's like. And they passed on me, and I looked at the guy sitting next to me. He goes, I don't know what happened. I said, well, I guess you're leaving now, aren't you? So it kind of – and then when I weighed down, the Washington Redskins had the last pick of the draft or the first round, and I'm like, okay, maybe I can go to the Redskins because I lived in D.C. area. And I grew up watching them and loving them. And they traded it to the Bengals. And the next thing you know, right when they traded it, Sam was on the phone. And next thing you know, I'm in Cincinnati the next day. So it was, you know, watching film on Anthony in college, it was a dream come true to be able to actually play with him.
Yeah, and you also had, like I said, there were three first-round picks that year. The first pick, Ricky Hundley, refused to sign with the Bengals. What were contract negotiations like with the Brown family? I've heard a lot of horror stories from other Bengals that I've interviewed, but what was your experience like with him?
Well, Mike Brown, I had a great agent. A guy's name was Jack Worth, and he was out of Chicago. And he got the fair value. You know, he wasn't one of those guys that, if he thought it was a fair value, every time we went into contract negotiation with the Browns, I think it only took a week. There wasn't one of these push-me-pull-you kind of things. It was just like, okay, Brian's worth this much. This is what he's done. You know, he had it all documented, and Jack would come to me and go, Brian, I think this is a fair deal. And I said, Jack, I trust you. And I would always sign. As far as, you know, the Browns, those guys have – they've helped forge my legacy with my family, but – you know, whenever anybody says anything negative towards them, they say Mike Brown doesn't know football. I think Mike Brown knows more about football than you could put I don't know how many other people in a room. Think of how many games that guy's watched. Think of how many practices he's watched. And to say that he doesn't know football is it's a travesty towards, you know, he was such a great guy.
Well, I think he was a good college quarterback, too, in the Ivy League, wasn't he?
Oh, dude, we're talking Ivy League? Come on, now. That's an oxymoron, if I've ever heard one.
Hey, Reggie Williams played in the Ivy League. Pat McAnally did. They were all right.
Yes, they were very well educated.
All right, so you talked about Paul Brown a little bit. I mean, what was it like being around a guy that was maybe the most innovative football mind in history?
What? Coming in, you really didn't know the history behind him. And then when you talk to some of the coaches and they would say, okay, you know, because at 21 years old, all you want to do is play football, have fun, drive cars, meet girls, all that stuff. And all the history part of it really didn't play into it. But when you got up to camp, that's when it did. Because to see how people would react when Paul would walk out, it was like the parting of the Red Sea. You know, and the funny story that I heard at one point, there was a tight end that they were going back and forth from training table, and this tight end was walking, and he was walking with Coach Brown, and he said, "Why do they all call you Coach?" Yes, the next day the kid was packing his bags. He was yes, but as far as innovation,
I bet he knew by then, though, why they called him.
Oh, coach. He did. He learned very quickly.
Now we'll talk about another coach you had with the Bengals, Sam Weish. Heard a lot of crazy stories about Sam, but it seems like all the players really liked Sam. You want to talk about Sam a little bit?
You know, Sam, another one of those guys that just a character, to say the least. His relationship with the players was uncanny, even though he struggled with remembering everybody's names, and it got to be a running joke to where he'd write somebody's name up on the board and it wouldn't even be their name, and he kept referencing it. He goes, okay, Chip's gonna do this and Chip's gonna do that, and later we find out later that he meant Skip McClendon, but we let him slide. So every once in a while we'd call Sam Steve, and we all had nicknames in the locker room. And
you had to call Skip Chip then every once in a while, didn't you?
If you walked in the locker room and walked through the locker room and said, who's this guy? And you'd see on his locker, it'd say Reggie Williams, or it'd say Boomer Esiason, or it'd say Bruce Kazerski. There was never once those guys weren't referenced as Boomer or Kazerski. I mean, everybody had a nickname, so it was kind of fun.
All right, 1984, your rookie season. You want to walk us through that? Were there any linemen? I know you had great linemen like Anthony Munoz. I think Max Montoya was there by now. You had some great guys to be around as a rookie offensive lineman. You want to talk a little bit about the 84 season?
Oh, yeah, sure. Coming in, obviously, the first person I see is Kenny Anderson. So, again, being young and you see Kenny Anderson, you watch him play all those games. I called him Mr. Anderson, and that took about 2 minutes until he said, okay, enough of this stuff. I'll use clean words, but he said, enough of that. We'll go ahead and call me Kenny from here on out. But no, just being around him, and you know, you watch him on TV. Isaac Curtis. I mean, heck, when you're growing up, everybody, when you got a touchdown, you threw that ball behind your back, just like Isaac Curtis would. And to be with him, it was just like, surreal is a good word, I guess, but that's the way it was for me. Dave Remington, I mean, you heard about him being the Lombardi Award winner, Anthony Munoz, number one draft pick. I mean, you see these guys and you see that they're just normal guys and they kind of take you under their wing, but they're pretty much celebrities when you first see them. So it took a little while to get you to, you know, to where they kind of brought you under their wing. And when we were up in training camp, that's when it all came together pretty well.
All right. Now, Will, you talked there about Kenny Anderson a little bit. A guy that was drafted right after you would end up being the quarterback a year later, Boomer Esiason. I know Boomer started a couple games during the 84 season, but it was kind of hit and miss on the success with him. Anderson ended up finishing the season. Team goes 8-8, made a run at the playoffs. Last game of the season, the Raiders couldn't help us out. But do you want to talk about him? Because Kenny Anderson and Boomer Esiason to me always seem to be like polar opposites. So could you talk a little bit, maybe compare the two quarterbacks?
Well, yeah.
Better, but just the way they carried themselves in a huddle and around the team.
You know, you talk about the huddles. I mean, the huddles, Kenny was the orchestra leader, and he was in charge. When you got in that huddle, he was pretty much, he commanded your attention. With Boomer, he was the kind of guy that you can get in a huddle and you say, hey, Boomer, this is, you know, check out of this play. I think we can take care of this guy. Anthony's kicking his butt over here. Me and Anthony, we're going to run this guy off the field. Or we're, you know, Boomer was a little bit more, he freelanced a little bit more because I think I don't want to say he had more smarts. I think with Kenny, he was, you know, Paul Brown's influence, you know, this is the way we're going to do it. It's kind of black and white. And I think Boomer was a good gray area quarterback because, you know, his knowledge and his, knowing what was going on and his confidence kind of made him a little bit more, he was a little bit more athletic and then a little bit more versatile as far as the offense went.
Okay. As an offensive lineman, who was the one or who was the hardest guy for you to deal with? You were getting ready to play a team and you think, man, I got to deal with this guy.
I have a picture. I'm sitting in my office right now and I have a picture behind me and where my butt is almost on the ground and I'm going against a guy from the New York Jets and it's Joe Klecko. That guy was about as big as a fire hydrant. Oh,
he's,
I know.
He was
about as big as a fire hydrant and about as sturdy as a fire hydrant, so you had to get lower than him, and I was 6'6", and he's only about 5'2", it seemed like, at the time, so to get down to that level was incredible, and Jimmy had a game plan. There was one game, we played them so many times, there was one game where Joe Klecko had a bad ankle, and, you know, you have a bad ankle, you kind of, in the NFL, you kind of got to take, you got to go after what will get you to the next level, so Jimmy saw that he had a bad ankle, and during the practice, he said, okay, if we don't cut him every play, I will get somebody in there to cut him. So Blades cut him every play, and I think, I don't know how many times in a row we cut him, and Klecko was like, God, you guys got to get off my legs. And anyway, it worked. I don't think he had a tackle in the game.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that when you realize that he doesn't even get considered for a Hall of Fame, I mean,
I think the playoffs and stuff like that had to do something with that. And he had Gastineau on their team, and you know they had other names on their team. Even though he was like our Tim Cromwell.
Yeah, with us. Let's go to the 1988 season. Like I said, I've probably had 15 of your teammates on here to talk about that, but that season. The season before, you had 1987, which had the end of the 49ers game. You had the player strike. I mean, everything kind of fell apart. People thought Sam Weiss was going to be fired. Paul Brown didn't fire him, brought him back. What was the player's opinion on Sam at that time before the 88 season?
You know, I think it was all water under the bridge towards the end. You know, everybody, once you got on the field, it was a just totally different game. And I think with Sam, he really threw the big wrench when he roomed us with, you know, we had black guys with white guys, and it was just, oh, God, just another crazy thing. Sam's come up with another crazy thing, and it's just like, okay, we'll do it. And that was the part, that was the
biggest part of our success. The chemistry, you know, everybody has their reason why they think that the chemistry of that team was so good. And I think that was the start of it. And it just built from there, and the confidence level of everybody, and knowing that if somebody broke down, there was somebody else that could just come right in and step right in. And I think all through the season, you saw that happening where we had quality players, and then every once in a while something would drop and somebody would step right back up into it and take over like there was nothing going on.
All right, so you've played all this time. You're finally at the biggest game in the history of Western civilization, as he used to call it on NFL film, even though they play it every year. So what was it like taking the field on Super Bowl Sunday?
Everything that you can imagine, but, you know, Mike, when you asked me to do this interview, I was very honored to be part of it, but I think the reason maybe I was asked is maybe I did have a pretty good run towards the end of that season, but it was all because of the rest of the team. And I think that my biggest hats off was to Joe Walter. I mean, Joe was, you know, he got hurt that last game of the season. He was having an all-pro season, and I was lucky enough to be able to step inside and play his position. But you talk about a guy that could have just said, you know what, I'm done. I did my part. And he could have sat back and pouted the whole time. That guy was by my side the whole time. And even on Super Bowl, that Super Bowl Sunday, it was, you know, he was right there by me the whole time. And he knew that we had his back the whole way. And it was a very special day. I mean, my family was there. My entire family was there. My soon-to-be wife was there. She was a girlfriend at the time. She was there. And just the enormity of knowing that millions and millions of people were watching, and it just was, I don't know, it just, it gives you goosebumps thinking about it to this day.
All right. Now, of course, that game did not turn out the way either one of us wanted. Still bothers me to this day. I have nightmares about it. And I didn't even play. I was like 18 years old, but I loved that team. I still got the Tim Crumright, King of the Jungle sweatshirt, all that stuff. But, talk a little bit about Jim McNally. I mean, Coach McNally, I think, is one of the, if not the greatest offensive line coaches, has to be in the top two or three. We had him on the show. He's a great guy. I mean, you want to talk a little bit about Coach McNally and the impact he had on you as a player and a person?
As a player, I had a very good coach in college. John Mathgau was one of the best. Matsko, he was one of the best offensive lineman coach back then, and everything was repetition. Jimmy came up to work me out in the off season, and I think those two had a relationship at one point where John would go and watch some of Jimmy's camps and stuff. The work ethic was identical, but Jimmy was just that much more intense. And it was a sense of, you know, nowadays it's like everything's a sense of urgency. And with Jimmy, every day, every minute of the day was a sense of urgency. But he also knew how to add some fun into it. He had players that wanted to play for him. We'd go out to practice and we'd bust our butt. I mean, sweating. Even on walkthrough days, we would be doing more. And we took pride in that. And, you know, having Anthony Munoz is a silent leader. He wasn't like the rah-rah guy. He would it on Sundays, but during the week, you just led by example. Max Montoya, another one, leads by example. But, you know, studying hard, knowing all the positions, I think you could interchange pretty much everybody on that offensive line, even though he had a set position for most everybody. He had everybody kind of knowing everybody's positions. And we were even good at reading. We would even be good at reading coverages, even though that really didn't have much to do with us. But, like, if you were out on a pulling play or if you saw that we were going to do a counter option or something like that, you would know, you would look at the cornerback and say, okay, they're playing this. So you'd be, instead of looking for an outside linebacker, he's going to have contain. You'd go up and you'd take a hard left before instead of going chasing the guy because you know he has the contain out there. So Jimmy was really good as far as the X's and O's and on the field repetition and getting us in the right position. And And adjusting to everybody's style. I mean, Anthony, he would leave alone, and with me, he might need to give me a little bit more extra coaching to, because I might not have had the physical tools that Anthony had.
All right, so you retired from football. What have you been doing since then?
I've been blessed to have a – I've been working with I worked with U.S. Foods for 17 years, and then I've since moved on to another food service company, and I have enjoyed that, enjoyed raising two wonderful children. I've got a son, Roman, who's 23 years old. I got a daughter that's 19 years old, and she's down at Clemson coming home tomorrow for spring break, so I look forward to seeing her. And I've got a beautiful wife for 25 years, and, you know, I've been blessed. I mean, I wouldn't trade my family for three Super Bowls. I mean, I've been blessed like that well. So, you know, I thank God every day that I have these guys, and they're my support.
Well, Brian, it's been an honor to have you on the show tonight. Anytime you want to come back, I mean, you need to come back and get on with me and Joe during the season for the Bengals Weekly Show next week or next year.
I love to, Mike, and you know what? It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing more. You've got more celebrities on your show than a lot of other guys. So, and it's fun to listen to them because they talk real, and that's what I appreciate.
Well, I appreciate that, Brian. I would like to make just one comment to all of our listeners out there. The first guy that I ever interviewed on this show a little over a year ago was Gary Jeter, former New York Giant, Los Angeles Ram, New England Patriot, played at USC, great player, had over 80 career sacks. Like I said, when I first started doing this, I mean, I just did it as a lark. I sent him a message on Facebook. He told me to call him. I called him on a Saturday morning at like 10 in the morning. We talked for like 4 hours, and he talked mainly about his Uncle Bob. His Uncle Bob Jeter actually played for the Green Bay Packers. He was a great player. Probably deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, but he kind of gets lost because of all the great Packers that were there with him. But, I mean, most of that conversation was about his Uncle Bob. I wrote a story about his Uncle Bob that was on Sports Rants that actually I'm going to post on thegrillingtruth.net here before the week's out. And, I mean, Gary was a great guy. And I remember the first time he was supposed to be on, it was supposed to be to talk about his Uncle Bob. And it was at a time where we didn't have the funds to do the show, you know, earlier in the day or to record it. We did it on Blog Talk at 11 o'clock at night. We're supposed to go on, me and Matt Andrew Scavage, my co-host. And Gary hasn't called in, and it's 20 after 11. And finally, Gary texts me on the cell phone. He's like, is it too late to call you? He said, I fell asleep, I didn't set my alarm, and I overslept. So Gary comes on, he talks for about 20 minutes about his Uncle Bob, then we had him on the next week to talk about his career. I mean, he's a guy that didn't know me from Adam, as the old expression goes, but we'd talked that one day, kind of hit it off, and I mean, we'd talked probably once a month after that for a couple hours, just about his career, stuff he's done. And really, the reason I do this show is for guys like Gary Jeter, Brian Blados, Jim McNally. I mean, people today forget about who got the sport to where it is. Even the NFL, because they don't take care of those guys. You know, they don't care. They just want to make their money. But that's the reason this show is here, is so everybody can tell their stories. And, I mean, I think it's great to hear from guys like Brian, Gary Jeter, all these guys. But I would just like to send my prayers to Gary Jeter's family. I mean, it's a huge loss. As I wrote today on social media, post I made, and I meant it completely, he may not have been a Hall of Fame player. He was damn near one, though. But he was definitely a Hall of Fame man.
You know, that's impressive, and that's awful nice of you, Mike. And you know, I think we're all in this fraternity together, and people that are listening to the show are definitely part of that fraternity because, you know, these are great stories, and they're great people that you're talking to, and we all put our pants on the same way, but I'll tell you what, we all have that same passion for football, and it'll never go away.
All right. So I want to remind everybody, check out our website. We got most things on there. We just put it up a couple days ago. John Jackson in Indianapolis put the website together. I'd like to thank him for that. It's thegrillingtruth.net. You can follow us on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, and about 10 other formats. Tomorrow, we will have a little bit different. We're going off the sports, a little bit off the beaten path. We've got our political show we just started today. We had Daryl Perry, who was a libertarian candidate for president. Unfortunately, he's a dumbass if you listen to the show, but he's fun to listen to. It was supposed to be like 45 minutes. I had to cut it off at 20 minutes because the guy was so stupid I was falling asleep. But tomorrow, we'll have libertarian presidential candidate John McAfee, who was the inventor of the McAfee antivirus. And tomorrow night, we'll have Dr. William Grome here for our holistic medicine show. He's going to talk about inflammation. And then next Monday, we will have Roger Brown, who, if you don't know who Roger Brown was, he was part of the fearsome foursome with the Rams. He played next to Alex Karras with the Detroit Lions. 1962 Thanksgiving Massacre. He sacks Bart Starr 7 times in a game. Roger Brown was truly a great player. I think he only played 7 years. He was a Pro Bowler 6 times. We will also next week have Gary Myers, who writes for the New York Daily News, who has a best-selling book, Brady versus Manning. He'll be on next week, early in the week, to talk about that. So make sure you check out our sponsors, Gridiron Mo. So go to gridironmo.com, realbengalfans.com, steelbergbox.com, and collegefootballvideos.com. That's the college football video website. Make sure you check that out, especially if you used to play college football or know somebody that did. He's probably got a film of it. So for Brian Blados, I'm Mike Gedpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.